from KUER News in Salt Lake City. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened in the Supreme Court this term. A lot, it turns out. Rulings on unions, on the travel ban, on gerrymandering, wedding cakes. And if that wasn't enough, Justice Anthony Kennedy has announced he's retiring. So what exactly does that mean? We'll have our court experts slash observers with us, and there's a lot to go through. So join us after this.
They say all politics is local, and KUER reporters are here to bring you Utah stories, news that affects you here at home, like public lands and water issues, religion, and the tech boom. You can trust KUER to bring you the facts and thoughtful analysis of why the story matters. Listen to KUER on air at 90.1, stream us at KUER.org, and here's a pro tip. If you've got a smart speaker, tell it you want to listen to NPR, and Alexa or Google will take you right there.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. There was going to be a lot to talk about today anyway, even if Justice Anthony Kennedy had not announced last week he is retiring from the bench. We would have had plenty to talk about. Nothing terribly sexy, though. Nothing all that groundbreaking. This seemed to be one of those terms observers say happens from time to time where the justices practice, you know, restraint, or depending on your perspective, they dodge the opportunity to make a larger statement on certain cases. Still, there were some important rulings on labor unions, on that high-profile wedding cake case, on Donald Trump's travel ban. But Anthony Kennedy's retirement is clearly the big news. So a good part of what we're going to talk about today will be what the retirement is going to mean for the makeup of the court, for the kinds of cases they take and the kinds of cases they rule on. We'll talk about Kennedy's legacy, where the center now is in the Supreme Court. But, of course, lots to talk about on the cases as well. So we're going to jump in. Rennell Anderson-Jones is back with us, a law professor here at the University of Utah's S.J. Quinney College of Law, clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, writes about media and the Supreme Court. She's back with us, and welcome to you.
Hi, great to be here.
Welcome back. Amy Wildermuth is back with us, even though she's just taken over as the dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, moved, of course, from the University of Utah. Still an adjunct professor there, so we still have her from time to time, and she's joining us here in the studio, which is kind of amazing. I should also point out she clerked for Justice John Paul Stevens and focuses on the Supreme Court and administrative law. And thank you for being here.
I am so happy to be here.
Okay, let's just start with some broad overviews. What I said about there being nothing terribly sexy or really all that groundbreaking, does that seem about right? Forget Kennedy for a bit. I know that's going to be hard to do, but just in terms of what we got, what do you think?
I think that's right. I mean, one of the things that is interesting about what we got is that we had a docket that was full of potential blockbusters, all of which fizzled a little bit and turned into the sort of smallest possible thing that the court could have said to us on the topic. This was true of the gerrymandering case, which we said at the beginning of the term would be the case to watch. Yeah. It was true of Masterpiece Cake Shop in some respects, which we said was sort of another case that was potentially sort of earth-shattering. What we saw this term was the court moving really incrementally, answering questions in as small a way as possible, or in some instances, declining to answer the very questions that they had suggested to us they would answer. Yeah. And I think that is an interesting thing to have happening at this moment in the court, both because of the Trump administration and because of the Kennedy retirement. We see the court sort of, whether purposefully or not, really holding itself back this term, not saying as much to us as it could have said.
So are you saying that they're in some ways taking the temperature of the landscape of the public and deciding we're going to act with restraint this time? What did you think, Amy?
I think it's very puzzling. There's a couple of cases that even if they took them and they just sort of decided they weren't quite the right case, I'm not sure what wasn't in the cert petition to identify the problems before they took them. And they also have a rule that was not in place when Ronell and I clerked, and that is a rule that Justice Scalia advocated for. Before they take a case, they have another review of that case to see if it's what we call a clean vehicle. Is it something that's going to allow us to resolve the question that we really want to reach in this case?
If not, why take it?
Right.
Yeah.
And why are we spending all this time? I mean, they've narrowed the docket. They hear so few cases at this point. It's such a lottery to get into the Supreme Court in the first place. And they seem to still have a problem, if that's what we want to call it, in picking cases where they can actually resolve the question that they thought they were going to resolve. So there's one of two things going on. Either they really got a lot of cases that had problems that they didn't realize or recognize at the outset, or they decided that they just really didn't want to answer those questions. Mm-hmm. And you wonder where that force is coming from to sort of go narrowly and carefully. And then you also begin to speculate, how much did they understand about what Justice Kennedy was going to do at the end of this term? And did that impact what they did in their cases?
Well, that's what I wanted to know. Do you think they knew this might be coming?
Everyone knew this might be coming.
Okay, right. Okay, of course.
Not everyone. Everyone who thinks about the court at all or thinks about politics at all was speculating.
But I guess if you're in the liberal wing, wouldn't you think, let me see if I'm Elena Kagan. Let me see if I can try to push this to some sort of resolution while we have the possibility of a swing vote.
Yeah. There's some possibility that it's Kennedy himself who was putting the brakes on some of these, right? He himself may, people were sort of reading him in conference and sort of taking his cues on things. And it might be that he himself advocated for these more restrained positions in some of the cases that could have been controversial or large, not wanting to sort of go out on those terms. We can't know.
But why would he do that? First Amendment, that's his thing. And isn't his thing also LGBT rights? That's another one of his things. And he had an opportunity to express himself on both of those. And in both cases, they kind of punted on that. It's baffling.
Well, it is and it isn't, right? Because that Masterpiece Cake Shop presented a problem for him. It was a problem. Which was going to win out? His First Amendment views or his advocacy for LGBT rights, right? So this is, I think it's very tricky. And the other thing I would say that I observe when I just look through the opinions for this term, where's the blockbuster Kennedy opinion? Where is it? There's no blockbuster 5-4 Kennedy opinion. He certainly joined the conservatives much more frequently. We know that. But where is his blockbuster opinion?
I think in Kennedy's mind, it's Masterpiece. Masterpiece Cake Shop was the threading of the needle between those two extremes that he has advocated for in the past. He's been passionate about First Amendment rights and passionate about religious liberty, and he's been passionate about LGBT rights and the sort of architect of the court's jurisprudence in that area in recent years. And I expect that he thinks that Masterpiece came out exactly sort of perfectly for in terms of his legacy, because if you're Kennedy and you're about to walk out the door and people are preparing their sort of, summaries of your life on the court, you don't want this one opinion at the end to undercut either of those legacies. And I think this is an incremental move that that keeps Kennedy's First Amendment legacy intact and his LGBT rights legacy intact, and saves for another day, which is sort of the theme for this court or this term of the court, saves for another day a lot of the very hard issues that we now know Kennedy won't be around to help resolve.
So, but the opinion that was written, nothing terribly lyrical or beautiful or even all that interesting.
It's in some respects just a recitation of the beautiful lyrical things that were said previously, right? So, and I think that was important. So it was important to Kennedy. You see this opinion, we speculated earlier in the term on a show with you, and everyone thought, to be fair, because it was litigated on these terms, that this was going to be a First Amendment free speech case, that this was going to be a question about whether the baker was expressing himself, was speaking by creating a cake. And we were going to have a lot of hard, tussly jurisprudential language about what counts as speech when you are, you know, producing a product for sale.
And we're all excited about that.
Yeah. There was oral argument was sort of dedicated almost exclusively to that. There, all the briefing was focused on that. And we said, Amy and I were out there saying to everyone, right, let go of the misconception that this is a religious liberty case. This case isn't being argued as a religious liberty case. Religious liberty arguments have long since fallen out. And then darned if Justice Kennedy didn't at the last minute turn it into a religious liberty case and focus on some very narrow facts that are quite limited to this case and the commissioners, the Colorado commissioners in this case, in ways that were not that expected.
Chastised the
he did chastise
Rights Commission, but do we get any guidance about public accommodation cases going into the future? Does this really provide any help in any of that?
So this is where it gets interesting for me. And everyone, the talk of the town was Kagan's opinion. I think there were, you know, there's separate opinions in the case. Several folks wrote. And one of the things that was really fascinating is that Kagan started in Masterpiece Cake Shop, probably a little earlier, but really picked up on it for this term, this pattern of writing a concurrence that says, you know, I can go along with the majority. We're going to go out on these narrow grounds, and here's why. But here's some other things that I think you should know about this case. And it became really persuasive. And she did this in a number of cases this term, so much so that there's actually one of the majority opinions in one of the cases where she concurs that actually says, by the way, we're the majority opinion. Just to remind everyone, this is the majority opinion, not that concurrence. That's very persuasive by Justice Kagan. So I think out of this, what I would point to is Justice Kagan's concurrence and ask questions about what that might mean for the future. I think what's also really interesting in this thread is just watching Justice Kagan and her sort of savvy in terms of bringing folks around on the court. I do think that that's one thing that we need to look out for as we look forward.
Well, I want to come back to that because I think that her relationship with Roberts is interesting.
Yes.
Her relation, these alliances that she's created, I think, with Gorsuch as well. And the big question now, of course, is what happens to precedent, stare decisis, and Roberts. It seems like she's pretty strategic. And we'll get back to Justice Kagan here in a minute because her dissent related to some of these First Amendment cases is interesting. She was the most interesting justice this term.
100%. I felt like this was Justice Kagan's term. That's what I would say. Justice Kagan was well known as the dean at Harvard for being able to get along with lots of folks, being able to find compromise, being able to sort of, there were roadblocks that had been in place people would describe. And I thought, you know, maybe that's just with the academics, but it can't work at the court.
Yeah.
It appears that she has now figured out ways to really work hard at the Supreme Court to find alliances. Now, that should not change our fundamental message here, which is when Justice Kennedy is no longer on the court as of July 31st, the court will shift.
Yeah.
It will be a very different place. But she has been fascinating to watch this
time. Yeah. One place where I thought she was incredibly fascinating was in the gerrymandering case, the Gill case, which was another that we sort of flagged as being one to watch, potentially if the court had in fact gone the distance and decided the constitutionality of partisan gerrymandering would have been absolutely the sort of watershed case of the term.
Let me mention it. It's Gill versus Whitford. Yeah. They sent it back to the lower courts, basically. The court was asked to decide whether this partisan gerrymandering, whether these claims are justiciable.
Yes.
I always have a hard time with that, which basically subject to a trial or a challenge, right?
Right.
Okay.
The stuff of which, the stuff that courts can tussle with and offer an answer upon. And
they just ditched. They basically said, these guys don't have standing
ditched.
To bring
yes.
it. Yeah.
You all are not the sort of people who were injured in the sort of way that we expect to see before we will dive in and tackle the actual question, the substantive question of the constitutionality of this. And in part, this was because people were challenging districts, saying all of the districts in my state were drawn poorly and in partisan ways. My own district is fine for me, and I maybe have enough voting clout within it. But the way that they were all carved up is constitutionally problematic. And the court said, no, that doesn't feel like a direct enough injury, and we're going to send it back. So again, we see Kagan writing separately. So that's 9-0. All nine justices agree to send it back.
Yeah.
But we see Kagan writing separately, essentially crafting a sort of play-by-play, you know, roadmap. If you're out there and you're thinking about wanting to challenge these partisan gerrymanders,
here's how you do it.
Here's how to do it, right? Here's what we would expect to see. A, B, C, you know, sort of just marching you through in a very methodical and careful and signal-sending way. And I think that's another sort of indicator that, you know, that Kagan is taking on a strategic role at the court and is becoming an important player. I wanted to just add that this notion of sort of writing a separate concurrence to add something important that she hopes people will think about in the past, that's a very Kennedy move.
Yeah.
That's the sort of thing that Kennedy's been doing for lots of years, sort of joining a majority and then writing a concurrence that that people have to take seriously. Hmm. I think Kagan may be filling that role in the years to come.
And, you know, we should also mention about the gerrymandering case, the standing issue. I don't mean to say that it isn't legitimate. You know, they had concerns about the people who brought the case, but it's very easy to fix. So this is not something that's going to tie up this litigation forever. It just says go out and get a few other people that can represent a couple of different things, and then we can hear this case. Well, it also gives them the great, you know, sort of luxury of not making a decision that's going to impact the midterm elections. I think they are very cautious about that.
I know, but they took the case in the first place. That's confusing.
And standing is not a hard thing
to suss
out at the beginning.
You can even just give indications that we don't think standing is appropriate here. But they took it.
Yes, and of course they took it in Kennedy's final year.
Yeah.
And Kennedy was really the person who had signaled for a lot of years that he thought that there might be some constitutional test that the court could apply to substantively think about these kinds of challenges. And now we won't have him. And so the question is whether Kagan's roadmap will matter at all, right? If once Kennedy is replaced, we might get a really pure, excellent, perfect case for them to think about, and it might still not get decided because the absence of Kennedy on the court could shift things.
Well, and when they take these cases that are not answering the question that they really focused most on in the briefing, et cetera. I mean, the standing question came up in the briefing, so I don't mean to say that it wasn't briefed, but it really wasn't the reason they took the case. And then we have a different problem that occurs, which is now we have some new precedent in an area that they really weren't intending to have. So that has other effects as well. I mean, it's just very strange to me. And again, I mentioned they have this new process in place that was supposed to solve this problem. That if we had a standing problem in a case where we really wanted to answer the question, we wouldn't take it. We would wait for another one.
Yeah.
And not only did they take, by the way, the Wisconsin case, they took the Maryland case, which was waiting for the Wisconsin decision. And we still don't. I mean, I just think this is one of their biggest flubs. It just feels like it's a very big flub.
Adam Liptak of the New York Times said he felt like in some ways it just seemed like Kennedy ran out of steam. Yeah. Do you think that's right?
Mm-hmm. Either ran out of steam or made a really savvy calculation that he was not going to go out as either the hero or the villain for anyone, right? Mm-hmm. And that definitely happened, right? Nobody's talking about Kennedy's most recent term when they're talking about his retirement and whether he planned that and sort of led us to a place where we could talk about his whole 30 years of jurisprudence rather than a couple of hot button things that happened in the last month. We can't know. We can't know now. History may reflect upon this better than we know now, but we don't know now.
That's a good diversionary tactic because he went pretty much with conservatives for the most of the term, right?
Yes. I mean, it's really interesting. I see sort of lots of liberal commentators sort of bemoaning his retirement, and there are, as we'll discuss, some good reasons for them to do so. But he didn't give them any reason to be sorry that he's leaving this term. To the extent there are any 5-4 decisions, he's in a 5 with conservatives.
And I think it would be worth noting that many people, when they read the concurrence that he wrote for Trump v. Hawaii, they said, this looks like a guy who's done. And if you read that concurrence, it does have this feeling of,
I'm spent.
You know, I'm I'm all out. And it has this sense of like there's he seems to be making a point about the Constitution is really important, and it but the courts aren't the only place that can do this. And so maybe it's somebody else's turn. I mean, it sort of feels like that. And there were a lot of commentators that then said, we think he's going to retire. But then when he didn't retire on the last day of the term, everyone thought, oh, you know, so it was a little bit of a fooler. I will say that.
Amy Wildermuth is with us, Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, Ronell Anderson Jones, a law professor here at the University of Utah. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll talk about the First Amendment. A lot of cases to talk about in this respect. And as Justice Kagan said, are conservatives weaponizing the First Amendment? We'll talk about that when we get back from a break. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
KUER teams up with local and national businesses around the state to support the station and bring you Utah stories and national news from NPR. If you've got a business, like a restaurant or a car repair shop, or maybe you take wedding photos or offer legal services, whatever it is, when you join KUER as a business sponsor, you're helping people who care deeply about facts and storytelling stay connected to their community, all while building your company's brand. Learn more about becoming a sponsor at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about what happened in the Supreme Court this term. And a lot happened. There were a lot of rulings on unions and a travel ban on gerrymandering. Not much of a ruling there, though. Wedding cakes. But this was not as important, it seems, as to what happened last week when Justice Anthony Kennedy announced he is retiring from the court. So we're talking about the cases and Kennedy with Amy Wildermuth, Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, joining us here in the studio, along with Ronell Anderson Jones, law professor at the University of Utah. Let's talk about the First Amendment broadly, and Ronell, I'll talk to get to you with this first. Conservatives have been using the First Amendment, the idea of free speech, as the basis for some of their conservative agenda. And even a lot of this related to deregulation, those kinds of things. Set this up for us, because then we can talk about Justice Kagan's dissent and how that's been working. But it seems to be working for conservatives right now.
Oh, it absolutely has been working. I think that this is one of the sort of flagship, notable trends that we've seen in the Roberts Court in particular in the last decade or so, this incredibly libertarian view of the First Amendment that neatly maps onto other libertarian tendencies of the conservative justices on the court.
Alito, and, Gorsuch now.
Yes,
right?
For sure. And it's a very interesting shift, right? Because a generation ago, the First Amendment was entirely or almost exclusively the province of the left. If you think about the sort of 1960s and 1970s, we're talking about liberal justices in the Brennan Court using the First Amendment to defend your sort of standard powerless speaker, you know, the person who wants to protest against the draft or the Vietnam War or the sort of fringe artist who does something controversial, the powerless. And the allegation that is being made against conservatives and that we're going to talk about in Kagan's opinion is that they have sort of weaponized the First Amendment to instead become a tool for the powerful, right? The Citizens United case is a very stark example that's made a significant splash in American politics. But it's not the only place. The First Amendment arguments are being made in a wide array of sort of economic and regulatory areas that we did not see in the past and are being embraced by Roberts and the other conservatives on the courts in ways that are striking down pieces of economic and social regulation that we wouldn't necessarily have thought a generation ago were the province of the court. They were not the sort of thing that the court would get involved in and are now being sort of constitutionalized as First Amendment issues and therefore being struck as unconstitutional in ways that are upsetting to Kagan and others on the left.
Let me read the Kagan dissent. Which is this case that she wrote this on?
It's Janus. It's the union's case.
Yeah. She said, today is not the first time the court has wielded the First Amendment in such an aggressive way. and it threatens not to be the last. Speech is everywhere, a part of every human activity. For that reason, almost all economic and regulatory policy affects or touches speech. So the majority's road runs long. And at every stop are black-robed rulers overriding citizens' choices. The First Amendment, she writes, was meant for better things.
Yeah. She's encapsulating something that's been simmering for a while. For a number of years, First Amendment scholars and commentators have been sort of noting this trend. And she's sort of reached a breaking point, right? And this term gave her plenty of reason to do so because we saw a lot of this happening. Janus, the case in which she said that, is a really strong example of that. To the outside viewer, this looks like it's a fight about unions, yeah, about the propriety of public sector unions and whether they should exist or not exist, and certainly those who have funded the litigation, right? It's a group of conservative activists who have funded this litigation for a long while, who have some fairly obvious political reasons for not wanting there to be strong unions, right? Unions traditionally vote Democratic, and Republican candidates don't like this. And so breaking them up would be a fantastic move for them. But the case comes to the court in First Amendment clothing. Yes. It's a First Amendment case about one's right to express oneself or decline to express oneself. And the way that this argument goes is, if I'm a member of a public sector union, already we had a long-standing line of constitutional doctrine that said never can you be forced as a part of a union to engage in the to pay for political activity with which you disagree, right? That's long since been clear, and it's not an issue in this case. But the issue here was whether you could be required to pay dues to the union for things like negotiating, right?
Collective
bargaining, the kinds of stuff that unions do for you as a worker. And the argument was made that the First Amendment even stretches to include those sorts of things because collective bargaining rises and falls in a public sector bargaining. It rises and falls on what sorts of things governments should do with their money and what sorts of ways governments should handle their staff and so forth. And that is speech expression on a matter of public concern. And so and the court, Justice Alito is writing for a 5-4 majority here. Justice Alito has signaled for the better part of a decade, please bring me such a case. Please bring me such a case. I really don't like these public sector unions. I really think there's a First Amendment compelled speech problem here. In fact, such a case was on the docket at the very moment that Justice Scalia died. Everybody at oral argument had sort of read the tea leaves and said public sector unions are going down. And then they didn't because Justice Scalia died and they were down a vote. Gorsuch joins the court, and 40-something years of precedent that had existed on this question were overturned, and the court, 5-4, decides that these unions, this required participation in these unions is unconstitutional, and you see that that sets Kagan off. She thinks you're wrapping this up in the First Amendment, but what's really going on here is something sort of overtly political, and that's damaging to the institution.
And of course, she had plenty of time to think about this because, as Ronell mentioned, there was a case that was going, you know, that was heard. She was prepared. And I think the longer you sort of see that that this is the direction we're heading, I think that did not help in sort of, you know, where her temperament ended up on this particular question, because all of us could see what the answer was going to be. It was just a matter of time. But I do think that there's now more literature out there and more awareness of how the First Amendment is being used by lots of different causes to do very interesting and new things in the law. And for Justice Kagan, that is not the direction that this was supposed to head. And of course, if we go back to Citizens United, which I know, you know, we could spend a whole other hour on, that probably is the place where this all began.
I wonder, along that line of getting these kind of full-throated dissents from the liberal wing, did you get some pretty powerful stuff from, I know, Ginsburg and others? They seem to be getting ready for bigger fights, and the fact that they're going to be just a very decided minority?
Well, I think it's going to be a very difficult thing. I mean, how do you become persuasive in that situation, right? And that gets us back to Justice Kagan and maybe some of the strategy that she's starting to embrace or has always embraced probably while she's been on the court. It is going to be a very different kind of court. And one has to figure out how to be effective in that setting. I don't know that there's any clear path for success other than to say, what are the things that we could work with? I mean, before the strategy was, in many respects, how can we figure out a way to bring Kennedy along? Or, you know, or where is Kennedy headed on this? And before that, it was Justice O'Connor, right? So there were. Now it'll be a new strategy, and it really will be focused on the Chief Justice, and it will be focused on that narrowness principle and stare decisis. That will be the emphasis.
I was listening to some of the comments in oral argument, and you'd hear this constant deference to Kennedy. Well, as Justice Kennedy has said, as Justice Kennedy has mentioned, and we noticed that Justice Kennedy has pointed this out. So it's going to be interesting, I guess.
Yeah, no one knows how to write a legal brief anymore. Erwin Chemerinsky, who is one of the top constitutional scholars in the country, once joked that if permitted, people would put a photo of Tony Kennedy on the front page of the brief to submit to the Supreme Court in order to highlight, we've written this just for you. And for a number of years, at least in some quadrants of the law, it was clear that it was Kennedy's court. And so it was the savvy, appropriate litigation strategy to write to his preferences and to cite his concurrences and to address things that they knew he would want to talk about.
Yeah. But there will be an opening. We saw a little with Gorsuch, right? If you have a vagueness question, you'll want to aim at you'll just have to employ different strategies now.
Like, that is how it works, though, right? I mean, they discern some way in oral arguments and in conference, I guess, how the doubts that they might have, and then you try to plug that into the way you make the decisions. I guess that's how it works.
And I think, you know, as the savvy Supreme Court litigators continue to watch, you know, I mean, there's not that many cases, right? So it's not that much, and they overanalyze it to death. So it's not that there are going to be too many surprises these days. I doubt that, but I think the key will be sort of where Roberts ends up really on narrowness questions and stare decisis.
We'll come back to that. Let's talk about the travel ban ruling, Trump versus Hawaii. The court ruled 5-4. Conservatives prevailed here. That President
Conservatives
Trump,
plus Kennedy.
Plus Kennedy, right? Yeah, I guess that's right. Yes, yes.
But Kennedy has always been a conservative.
That's right.
So we should all just acknowledge that here.
Yeah. But, the court ruled the president did have legal authority to restrict travel from several of these mostly Muslim countries. I'm so interested in this. Ronell, you talked about how interesting it was that the court seemed unwilling to engage the factual record of Donald Trump.
Yeah. If you read the opinion here, which was written by Chief Justice Roberts.
No one referred to tweets, for example, right?
People are referring to the presidency.
Yeah.
But not to the president. So he, in passing, he has to engage briefly with the fact that this travel ban, which is neutral on its face, we should say, right? If you read it, it says these eight countries, six of which happen to be predominantly Muslim countries, these eight countries are banned, and that's our policy going forward. It's the third iteration of this policy. The earlier versions, particularly the first version, were overtly targeting Muslims. But the piece of policy that the court has before it at this very moment is this neutral on its face policy. And the Roberts opinion focuses on the policy on its face and then engages in really an analysis of the relationship between the Supreme Court and the president, right, on these sorts of topics. The Supreme Court doesn't step in some sorts of areas, right? We are called upon statutorily or constitutionally to show deference to the president in certain areas. There's statutory language that suggests he has broad powers in immigration. There's constitutional jurisprudence that suggests he has broad powers in national security. And therefore, this is in the clear, right? This doesn't violate constitutional norms. We see the dissenters particularly Sotomayor.
She read from the bench.
Angrily, passionately saying, this isn't just a president, right? This is this president who has retweeted anti-Muslim material, who repeatedly said at the campaign trail that he would block Muslims out, that Muslims were dangerous, that we should hate them, and so forth, and that that record should manifest itself, should have some impact on our decision making here. She pointed, I think, really interestingly to the case that the court had just decided, you know, a week earlier in Masterpiece Cake Shop. Because as we said, Masterpiece Cake Shop was in some respects viewed by a lot of scholars as being parallel in a really important way, which is Masterpiece involved a facially neutral law, an anti-discrimination law. You know, you can't discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. But there was this background history of some commissioners saying some very nasty things that were sort of had undercurrents of religious animus and hatred towards the Christian baker that changed the outcome there, right?
So it wasn't okay then, but right. Somehow it is okay.
Yes, and
now.
This is where Sotomayor sort of gets off the train and says it's unacceptable for us to blink at this history of religious animus that on the part of the president. And that's the divide, the 5-4.
Yeah. And the decision maker here, I mean, it was a little different kind of decision, right? But it is true that you have a decision maker that expresses animus in one case, and that is the basis of the decision to send it back. We can't have it. We then have a decision maker in the president, and because it's special and the president, it seems to not matter. Now, it was very interesting when I read Chief Justice Roberts' opinion. He has this very interesting line about what President Bush had done after the 9/11 attacks. And you think it might be headed in a little different direction.
Yeah. Oh, no. What a president says matters.
Yes, and it does matter. And remember how he embraced it. And so it was a very interesting opinion. But it really did sort of solidify where I think you can imagine a court for the next few years.
Yeah. And to be clear, the cases are distinguishable, right? Immigration is different and national security is different. There are loads of ways on which we can say this comes out differently because of these particular factual premises. But mainly, I think what we're seeing here is Roberts having an incredible concern for being perceived as a court that is activist.
Yeah.
And this is particularly sensitive given the accusations in the Union case and in others that, you know, the dissenters are writing. You, the conservatives, who have for many years sort of railed against judicial activism, are just overturning precedent because you like the political outcome. You can see that Roberts has an incredible sensitivity to that. And he's writing in the travel ban case in a tone that suggests we, the court, are not going to leap into these sorts of things. You can count on us. We're going to be neutral and we're going to proceed with caution. And the integrity of the institution is still stable.
How many more clues could he be giving about Roe versus Wade?
It
seems like that's what he's doing.
It does appear that way. I mean, it would be difficult to make any jump to any conclusions or really figure out exactly what he thinks. But we do see this emphasis on, you know, we want to stay narrow. We don't want to be activists. But, you know, you can always change the seat that you're sitting in and then it doesn't look as activist. So that, I think, is one of the things that we have to also put out there, that he may see Roe v. Wade as a very different sort of, you know, endeavor altogether.
OK, I don't want to jump the gun on that. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Did you want to say something about this Carpenter v. United States case?
It's the longest opinion that we have. I mean, I think we have over 100 pages. You know, we got to spend our time there at the Supreme Court.
Another 5-4 case.
Another 5-4.
The Chief Justice joined the liberal wing.
This is the interesting part, right? We have the Chief Justice joining the liberals. And this was the case that we discussed before that had the at-issue cell phone records. So the location data for cell phone that a guy was using who was accused of committing several crimes. And the upshot is that Carpenter won. And the interesting part of this was to figure out exactly how far the court might go when it comes to this data. There was one aspect of the
case. And the court said that you need a warrant. Generally,
exactly.
You need a warrant.
You need a warrant. Yeah. And one of the things that was out there and had been prior precedent is this thing called the third-party doctrine. children. And so that meant that if you gave, you voluntarily gave things to some third party, they could hand it over. That was very quickly sort of eliminated from the case. And so, in other words, the court said that is not something that we're going to accept in sort of what is now called the cyber age. We should all understand that's two words and it's capitalized, kind of like the ice age. Kennedy helped us with that in a different case called Wayfair. But now that we're in the cyber age, and the Supreme Court has recognized this new cyber age, they are not going to have most of the justices, in fact, beyond the 5-4 majority, understand that we have a much different kind of technological situation that's not really going to work in terms of how they think about this. So Chief Justice Roberts wrote a very interesting opinion that was much broader in some respects than folks had thought in terms of how he could decide the law. But then at the end, he says, and here's all the things we're not deciding. So he still wanted to keep it really, really narrow to say here. And one of the big issues in this case is how many days the government had of this information. And the magic number became 7, which no one, as far as I can tell, no one can understand exactly why the magic number became 7 days of data, because it appears in the case they actually only had 2 days. So not quite sure, but apparently this 7 days is some sort of magical dividing line. And that 7 days, they said, when you get that, you must go out and you must get a warrant to get that data.
Today in the program, we're talking about what happened in the Supreme Court this term. And what happened that was a big deal, just learned last week, is that Anthony Kennedy is retiring the 31st of this month. So we're going to sort of turn to that now. It's not like that's all we haven't been talking about. Mostly everything seems to turn to Kennedy. Rennell Anderson-Jones is with us, teaches law at the University of Utah. And Amy Wildermuth is back with us, dean at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Okay, so is this the biggest thing that happened this term?
Far and away.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, like, unquestionably. Down, right? It's the biggest thing that's happened in a generation at the court.
Well, Rennell, you said what happened with Kennedy, this retirement, renders a lot of what happened as sort of kind of past tense now. What does that mean? Like everything's up in the air now?
It does.
Way?
Well, as we were saying before, a lot of the cases this past term were litigated directly to Justice Kennedy in an effort to get him as the swing vote and to sort of track where he is on things and on loads of issues where he's been the critical fifth vote. All litigation strategy has been designed around him, right? No one litigates an affirmative action case without litigating it directly to Justice Kennedy. No one litigates an LGBTQ case without talking straight to him. Abortion issues are all about, right, sort of threading the needle to find where Kennedy is. Death penalty cases. He won't overturn the death penalty as unconstitutional, but he has joined conservatives in some cases to say it's unconstitutional if the person is a minor or if the person has a mental disability and so forth. Right, they're sort of targeting his direct needs. On all of those, he's not fully in the camp with the liberals. He's sort of making compromises, and a lot of litigation has happened on Kennedy's terms. And if, as we can only assume will be the case, he's replaced with someone who is to the right of him on those issues.
Good bet.
Yeah. Every person on Trump's list of 25 from which he has promised to choose the person is to the right of him on at least some and probably all of those issues, then we're litigating in a whole new world. It is no longer Justice Kennedy's world, and the question is, what world is it?
How did this play out, do you think, to the degree that you might know, you know, wooing Kennedy to making him reassured enough that he can retire and feel good about it, because there are a number of his former clerks that are now on the list. And I'm wondering if that played a part in this kind of backstory.
I'm sure that it did. I think, but I also think that he has been signaling for some time that he would retire. And I would have imagined that he would have retired whether it was a President Clinton or a President Trump. Which may be going too far, but I think he just has not seemed to want to continue. And there was lots of sort of anecdotal stuff that was going on that, you know, he wasn't feeling as great about it, maybe not feeling personally as energized about the court. So I think we had lots of signals that this could inevitably happen. Then I'm sure that everyone who was eager to have him step away and have someone a little bit more to the right be a possible candidate, tried to do everything in their power to make the case for Justice Kennedy to step down. But I have to say, my personal view is that it was going to happen within this time period, no matter
what. So he wasn't going to wait for the second term.
But to be fair, the guy turns 82 this month, right? He's entitled to retire. I wish not to be working when I am 82 years old.
I also have to say, I worked for Justice Stevens when he was 82, and he spent several more years on the bench. And he was great. I mean, I think the one of the really interesting things that happens is you figure out people age in very different ways. And we all have experience with 82-year-olds who are as young as anyone else on the street, right? And then you have experience with 82-year-olds that it's a little harder road, and you just don't know exactly how any one person will age.
Well, we've all seen documentaries of Ruth Bader Ginsburg doing squat thrusts and all those kinds of things.
Especially with all her health challenges, being able to do that, right?
Yeah. Well, the one thing that I think is interesting about the way this now turns to Donald Trump is he has been quite clear that he is going to use his, at least on the campaign trail, he's going to use his Supreme Court appointment to target specifically abortion rights.
Mm-hmm. Although he did say in an interview, I think on Fox News, I think that's the only place that really gets interviews with him, right? So I'm probably guessing correctly here.
Yeah.
He said, they told me not to ask the candidates about Roe v. Wade. I don't know, you know, it got reported that he wasn't going to ask about Roe v. Wade. But what really happened is, when if you hear the live version of it, he says, well, they told me I can't ask about that. So it appears, but it seems
so he
that
did
that's been
defer to the norm there.
Yeah, it appears that he may be, but of course, most of this list has been vetted with Roe in mind. I mean, we have to understand.
Let's talk about a couple. Amy Coney Barrett. She's in her mid 40s, extremely conservative. How high up on the list do you figure she is?
If I were laying money on it in Vegas, Amy would get my vote.
Yeah,
she's top two at least.
She's certainly unquestionably on the short list. And she might be particularly appealing to the president for a couple of reasons. One reason is that he himself named her to the federal bench. So to the extent that he thinks he's done a great job of naming federal appellate court judges, it would reaffirm that to elevate such a person to the Supreme Court. I think it's appealing in some quadrants to the extent that Roe is on the line, to the extent that there is some thought that there might be someone who overturns Roe, the idea that a conservative woman would be the person doing that might be appealing.
It makes sense strategically.
It might also cut the other direction, right? Amy Coney Barrett has maybe the strongest anti-Roe record of any of the people on this list. She was an academic for a lot of years at Notre Dame. She's an ardent Catholic. She has seven children and is a deeply religious person and has written about religious liberty issues and about their intersection with abortion in ways that might be too hot button for the Senate. Is very, very tight right now.
Very.
Very tight. If McCain doesn't show up because he's ill, we only need one or perhaps two defectors.
Susan
from
Collins, Lisa Murkowski.
Yeah, and so they might actually be turned off by someone who has the strongest anti-Roe record, and that's the sort of one hesitation that I have on that front. But I think that people are definitely talking about Barrett, and for good reason. And she has all the right kinds of credentials. She was a clerk at the Supreme Court. She clerked for Justice Scalia. She currently sits on the Seventh Circuit Court of Appeals, a very well-respected appellate court. Smart and interesting and thoughtful and young.
Young. I was going to say, that ticks all the boxes, at least in that way.
Yeah. She's pretty also. to the extent that the president has used words like, I want people out of central casting, like somebody who looks great on camera, Justice Barrett would also tick that box.
Yeah, I thought that it would be inappropriate for me to say anything, you know, that the president might pick someone on the basis of looks. But then when the president decided that he could say that out loud, I don't feel it's inappropriate anymore. So I do think, I mentioned this when Justice Gorsuch was selected. These folks that are on the list, let me say, they are all very well qualified. There is no question that they are all very well qualified. This is not a Harriet Meyer situation. This is a very different kind of situation. It's just that people will very much disagree if you believe that when you went to vote for president, if you were voting for someone that would appoint a different kind of person, this will be very troubling. But of course, that's why a number of people, at least in polling, have said that they went and voted for Trump, essentially holding their nose, was for this pick. So we have to understand that that was what was at stake in the election. And, elections have consequences.
Let's come back around to this question of stare decisis. It seems like Chief Justice Roberts, has in mind the idea of tempering rulings and opinions based on a respect for precedent, but also a respect for at least an acknowledgement of the divided nature of the country and the role he thinks the court should play. Let's talk about that finally. What happens, and maybe you can say it just related to Roe versus Wade, but what happens now in that respect?
Yeah, I think that's going to be the biggest issue going forward. It seems unquestioned that we're going to get a court that is to the right of the court that we have now. And there's a court, it will be a court that is populated with individual jurists who, if they were considering these questions from scratch, would be inclined to rule differently than the court has ruled in the past. But the court isn't deciding these questions from scratch. There's precedent that exists. And adherence to precedent is very, very important to the court, and particularly important, I think, to the Chief Justice right now, because history will mark him, right? The Roberts Court is what we're going to call this period. And he doesn't want to have a legacy of having been overtly political in a branch that is designed not to be. And so what we see is a lot of language from Roberts on that front. We see a lot of folks think sort of the Obamacare decisions that were decided were Roberts' effort not to have his court be seen as overtly political. There's language in from the founders that refers to the court as an entity that has neither purse nor sword nor purse, right? The idea is all the other branches, they have money and they have armies and they can harm us in all sorts of ways, but we also have all kinds of political control over them. This entity is meant to be different. It sets aside from this. It follows its own rules. It engages in clear logic and decision making, and then it can be counted on to continue to obey its previous precedent. And so something huge like the overturning of a major case is going to be something that will make at least some justices, and most notably the Chief Justice, at least a little bit skittish.
I think that I would just focus on exactly how the cases might come to the court and how they might strategically approach them. With a new nominee, I don't think the strategy is going to be to go full out, full stop, overturn Roe v. Wade. The strategy, understanding Roberts, will be to narrow it, right? So it's a death by 1,000 paper cuts. What will happen is that over time, there will be, sort of cutting back. Now, how far Roberts is willing to go, we'll see.
Amy Wildermuth, Dean at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Even though she's not at the University of Utah anymore, she's still with us, so that's a good thing. Thanks very much for making the trip. And Ronell Anderson-Jones teaches law here at the University of Utah still. Glad of that. Thanks very much.
Thank you for having us.
Great to be here.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. So we didn't get to everything in the show today. One thing that we wanted to talk about was of the potential candidates or nominees for the court on the list, whether it's the short list or not, or the potential for Mike Lee and his brother Tom Lee. Let's start with Mike Lee. He is conservative, ticks some of the boxes. Would he be appealing at all to Donald Trump?
He certainly has some very strong backers within the national conservative movement. So we've seen people like Ted Cruz sort of openly advocating that he's the best man for the job. He comes from a very prominent Supreme Court family. Their father, Rex Lee, was Solicitor General of the United States, which is an incredibly powerful position at the Supreme Court. You litigate all of the cases on behalf of the United States government for the court. And he wasn't just a Solicitor General. He was sort of widely regarded as one of the most renowned Solicitors General, a very talented advocate and a really savvy thinker about the Constitution and about the court.
Incredibly well-respected.
Incredibly well-respected across the aisle. And so I think and we've seen Mike Lee is in a unique situation because he's not a sitting judge. Yeah. So he's one of
That frees him up.
It does. The other folks who are on this list are people who are very careful about talking to the press and sort of refuse to do so. So in contrast to his brother Tom, who is a justice of the Utah Supreme Court, who put out a statement that he has no comment about his name being on the list, Mike Lee is free, to go on the news and to say what an honor it would be to do it, and to describe the ways that he grew up watching the court with his dad, and in ways that are sort of interesting, things that we don't usually haven't really seen in the past. Donald Trump himself has commented on that, right? He said, "Oh, it seems like he would like this job, and that he's." Interested in it, and that's an exchange between potential nominee and president that we ordinarily historically don't see because the dynamic is usually a little different. He's young. He's in his 40s, which ticks a really important box. The president has said he wants to appoint someone who could serve for, his language was 40 or 45 years. I don't know.
That's ambitious, even for the 40-year-old.
I don't know that Mike Lee has 40 or 45 working years left, but he is on the younger side of the people who are on the list, which I think might make him attractive.
What do you think about Mike Lee?
I think that I would imagine that one of the things that you could say with respect to Senator Lee is that he doesn't have a track record as a jurist. And one of the things that has seemed important is to have a track record as a jurist. So his brother, Justice Lee, very well known, very well regarded.
Not as high a profile nationally, but you say more respected in the...
I think very respected in the circles that we're talking about that are interested in getting these nominations moving forward. I certainly think he is very, very well regarded, for example, in the Federalist Society and within other organizations that have watched his jurisprudence. And again, he has that track record. So there's something more certain about that, if you will.
But he's in the West. So was Gorsuch the last. Would that even matter to a Donald Trump or court watchers?
Yeah, it's tricky to know how geographic diversity would strike. They certainly played that up a lot at the Gorsuch hearings, right? That he was this sort of aw-shucks Westerner. Despite the fact that not being entirely factually true, Gorsuch's mother was a Washington insider and a high-level EPA official, and he went to high school at an elite D.C. Private school. So so you could see that
people play that up when it works for them.
That's right. There's some attractiveness to having geographic diversity on the court, and you can imagine that a populist president who has worked hard to appeal to a populist base would like the idea of sort of being able to say, I haven't populated the court with the same sorts of Harvard, Yale, East Coast liberal or East Coast conservative, right? East Coast legal elites.
Yeah.
I'm representing more of the country. There are lots of folks on the list who are from places like Indiana, or sort of middle of the country folks, Midwesterners who might also be appealing for those reasons. But I will second what Amy said about Justice Tom Lee. He might not have a broad national profile in terms of sort of, lay folk. But within conservative legal communities, he's a big name. He has a reputation for being a sort of strict textualist. He's been one of the most prominent jurists in the country to embrace a line of judicial thinking that focuses on reading sort of a corpus of material from a brand of textualism where... Very Scalia-like in an almost more technical way of sort of analyzing the actual words of the day and the ways that they were empirically analyzing the ways that those words were used and rolling them out. He's written some very prominent law review articles on that topic, a most recent one published in Yale. He's a very well-respected jurist and thinker, and has all of the right conservative credentials. He clerked on the Supreme Court for Justice Clarence Thomas.
Is he as conservative as his brother?
I think they're conservative in different ways, right? So, Senator Lee does a
one's a politician,
job, right?
Yes,
and he's
they've had different
politician.
Ways to manifest their conservatism to us.
I think it's a very different kind of thing. The other thing I would say is that I don't know that President Trump has in mind any particular story, but what he likes is a really good story. And we know this because he was on a reality show for a really long time, right? So I don't know that he's predisposed to have anybody from any particular place. But what he's looking for is what's going to be the really great story. What's going to look good when he presents this to the country and to hit all those folks who voted for him that he wants to have vote for him again, right? So I don't know that there's any one story, but he's going to want a good story. And I think the Western story about Gorsuch was as much Gorsuch's sort of, identification and how he thinks of himself as much as it was everyone else kind of thinking about that.
So it sounds like you'd be surprised if Mike Lee were nominated, not so much with Tom Lee.
I don't know that he's in the top two. Yeah. I would say Brett Kavanaugh.
Say something about Brett Kavanaugh, because I think he's interesting.
So Brett Kavanaugh has been on the D.C. Circuit since 2006. He is very affable, very personable,
handsome.
And handsome, which may be important.
And he's a former Kennedy clerk.
Yes. And he is. He has quite a track record, right?
I'll just say I think that might be a – is that a clincher? I mean, the idea that it's a Kennedy clerk, and was that at all appealing – to Anthony Kennedy?
President Trump said publicly that he met with Kennedy at the time that Kennedy tendered his resignation, and that he specifically asked him, Justice Kennedy, who do you think would be a good person to replace you? Now, he didn't specify that whether Kennedy answered or not. So, I mean, remember, we're left to assume that happened, and maybe it did not happen. Gorsuch is a Kennedy clerk. And so it would be very, very interesting if the two replacements that happened back to back were replacing Kennedy with a Kennedy clerk. I think that would be a really interesting move. Kavanaugh was a Bush appointee to the D.C. Circuit. The D.C. Circuit is, I think it's not an exaggeration to say, right, the best regarded circuit in the country in terms of people going from it to the United States Supreme Court. Scalia did so and Ginsburg did so. And so he is truly a candidate that universally would be regarded as qualified for this job. He's in his early 50s. He's a little bit older than I can't believe that, somebody who's 52 or 53 is now being aged out of this job
of 40 to 45 years.
That's right. Exactly. Yes. So he's a little older than some of the other candidates who I think are probably on the short list. He's older than Amy Coney Barrett. He's older than Amul Thapar, who most people think is on the short list. I would put him in the top two or three. I'm guessing that there are serious conversations happening about Brett Kavanaugh right now at the White House.
And we should say just one thing about that conversation that Trump said he had with Justice Kennedy. Nina Totenberg has reported that on good authority, she has good authority, that the conversation did not go, from Kennedy's perspective, in nearly the same way as the president has recounted.
How surprising.
So, yes. So I think it's fascinating. There's one other person we should mention, and that's Hardiman, who was basically the runner-up last time. Mm-hmm. And he's on the Third Circuit.
Who is this?
This is Tom Hardiman, who is on the Third Circuit and is allegedly, we understand, a favorite of Trump's sister, who is also on the Third Circuit. So Judge Barry is his sister. And he is quite an interesting choice. One wonders, if you were the runner-up, if you might make it the next time. Sometimes that precludes you. Sometimes, you're not going to be a finalist the next time around. But I am hearing that he, too, is in that group. And I think he meets a lot of the criteria that Trump looks for. He does have a really good story. He drove a taxi, you know, to make
That's
money.
For
first-generation college student.
College, right? He went to Georgetown, so a little off the beaten path. Mm. Again, one of those stories that I don't think there's any predetermined story. You just have to have a good
one.
Story.
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah,
Hardiman
right.
is 52 to the extent that we're keeping track.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe there's no way of knowing this, of course. We should be getting an announcement fairly soon, right?
I would expect a week from today.
Okay.
Yeah, on the 9th. And they're getting interviewed, I think, in New Jersey. Mm-hmm. I think all of them are going to New Jersey to meet with them. I don't know why.
Amy Wildermuth, Dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Ronell Anderson-Jones, law professor here at the University of Utah. Thank you both again for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.